For a long time, California was thought of by many as the state that took the lead when it came to an individual state fighting global warming and climate change. But now, there's the Empire State. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Last Monday, July 1st, we had a show about climate change where we also focused on the rising waters in our region and the impact it's already having on our shorelines. David Wallace Wells, the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, was one of our guests. And like many shows about climate change that we've done, it was sobering and somewhat disheartening. But there are still many who are optimistic that with technology and taking the right actions, catastrophe can be averted. Taking a bold step, New York State lawmakers recently passed a climate plan that some say is one of the most ambitious in the world. State Senator Todd Kominski is a Democrat. He represents the 9th District and is the Senate sponsor of the bill. And Assemblyman Steve Englebright is also a Democrat, the chair of the Environmental Conservation Committee, and he represents the 4th District. Assemblyman, Senator, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Senator, can you give us the major goals, please?
Sure. The Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act is really the most aggressive greenhouse reduction plan in the country. It would do two main things, and then I'll get into how it would be accomplished. But the main thing it would do would be saying that our state by the year 2050 will have a carbon neutral economy, meaning that we are not adding, as an entire state, every person in it, all the manufacturing, all the housing, all the transportation, we will not be adding any carbon to the atmosphere. And it also means that by 2040, we're going to have a carbon-free electricity sector, meaning that we will not be emitting any carbon in producing any electricity. And so to the extent that there will be people emitting where it cannot be helped or technology is not able to stop them from emitting carbon, it will be offset. And that's only a small amount of the entire economy. So we're really talking about, a giant shift in how our economy is going to be, working vis-a-vis the environment in the next 31 years. And it also means that we're going to be first movers in a new green economy. We want to be the locus of where companies are investing, where jobs are being created, where training is happening, and where other states are looking to get their green energy and to have their workforce trained. And I think there's a big advantage in being that first mover.
Senator, can you define offset for us, please?
Sure. So to the extent that there are manufacturers who have tried their best with the most modern technology but still cannot refrain from emitting, they can make investments to offset what they're doing by making investments in carbon capture, whether that is in forestry, investing in wetlands, investing in energy efficiency and low-income housing. Basically, we're going to leave it to the DEC, the State Environmental Agency, to create a program that has pretty strong guardrails on it to make sure it's not being abused. But that certainly allows industry to know that it's going to have a place in the state of New York as long as it is trying to be the best environmental steward that it can be.
Assemblyman, is this one of the most ambitious plans in the world, as some have claimed?
It is, and it's appropriate that New York, as it has a place in the world, that if it wasn't the state, it would be large enough economically to be a nation. It's appropriate that we help lead the way. We've done important things as a state in the past. That's why we're the Empire State. And we should set an example for the world, especially in the context of what is not happening that should have been continued. The Washington scene is very anti-environmental and very short-sighted, and we have a longer view. And this bill, as the senator has indicated, is a multi-decade commitment to making sure that New York helps set an example for the nation and the world.
All right, Assemblyman, I know you say you're taking the long view, but in the meantime, 2040 is going to be here before we know it. It's only 21 years away. And it's you have an aggressive plan. Not to be flip about it, but is it doable? I mean, can you make it in that short period of time?
I believe it is doable. By the way, I'm a geologist, so I think both in real time and in geologic time, and this is just as aggressive as we can be within the context of any way you want to measure time. But we need to. The consequences, we're getting a preview of those consequences. 100-year storms are coming every 3 years or so now. We have rising sea level storm effects in upstate communities that are reactivating long dormant boulder systems in streams that are bouncing down into villages during heavy storm events. But on the larger global sense, New York has a role to play, not only by taking care of business here, but having, again, the ability to help set an example that others can take heart from. Mm. It's easy to get discouraged, but discouragement or a lack of focus will only lead to a catastrophe in the future, and the future is coming fast.
Yeah, and Ron, this is Todd. Let me just add to that. Look, it would obviously be preferable. I think everyone agrees if Washington did this and all states had to act at the same time and you know, be on the same level playing field. But that's not an option that we have. And when we talk, unfortunately, and when we talk to scientists who know this stuff well, they're telling us that we don't have time to act. We don't have time to wait. We don't have time to just hope this gets better on its own or that Washington will get its act together. So as one of the largest economies in the world, you know, we are an important state. It is of consequence. It would be bigger than the economies of, you know, many nations. And as someone that other states look to, we thought it was imperative for us to start moving. And if other states, especially the ones around us, join in, we can have some real synergies, some real actions of consequence that will impact the environment. I think if you take the view of, hey, this is just spit in the ocean, what's the point? It's a defeatist attitude that we can't really afford to take. We're doing the opposite, which is we want to be on the ground floor of a new green economy. We want other people to follow, and we actually don't have a choice. So let's get off the bench and start doing that.
Senator, right after the break, I'd really like to delve into the regional aspect and what is being done or not being done on the national level. But I just, before our break, I want to ask you about the business aspect of it, because you and me and the Assemblyman, we all see the same reports. And you know that some business groups simply disagree with this. They say, and their words are, it's completely impractical. And they're asking, where's the money going to come from to do this?
Well, so I'd say a couple things. First of all, the Business Council of the State of New York actually gave a fairly positive review of this law. And they believe that the offsets are very helpful in allowing industries to know that they have a future to manufacture in New York. It is very difficult when somebody could just move to another state. You know, the technical term is called leakage. And if another, you know, if another state just a few miles away, whether it's Pennsylvania or New Jersey or Connecticut, is not having these same rules, it obviously is impactful, and we wanted to account for that. So I think we did a good job doing that. But I'll also say this, you know, we obviously have to look at the information in front of us. We had hearings throughout the state, and I fully believe this is doable, and I fully believe that we will send the strongest market signal that will lead to better technologies, plummeting prices, and I think we will look back on this in a few years, and those doubts will be erased because we will, you know, kind of have changed the economy and how we do it. But that obviously is not a given. We have to work toward that. And what this bill does is sets up a climate action council that is going to help us do smart, thoughtful planning on how to get from here to there. This is not just, hey, we're going to set these goals out there, go reach them. We're going to have experts, agency heads, people involved in the energy industry, the transportation industry, home manufacturing industry, et cetera, helping us figure out the best way to get to those goals, the best incentives, the best way to encourage these investments. And obviously, figure out whether state money will have to go or have to be raised to accomplish some of this. That council will be established pretty soon. They will start getting to work, and we did not want to waste another year in having that process begin. So we're getting that started, and we're going to have to make sure we continue to work toward smartly coming up with those goals. There's no reason why this has to result in the doom and gloom that people predict. We're not even sure exactly how we're getting there, but we know we can get there, and we know that we want to have the best council helping guide the way.
Assemblyman, I only have 30 seconds before I have to break, but what do you tell the business groups who have their doubts?
Well, what is the alternative? If you believe that there is a climate change issue, you need to deal with it. And we're not offering a formula for how to do that. We are putting the stakeholders together. I anticipate that business groups will be part of that 22-member Climate Action Council, and that the result will be that they'll have the ability to work together. And in fact, we're all in this together, and we're going to have individuals from all of the sectors working toward the common goal of protecting our future.
Assemblyman, let me hold you there just because I have to take a short break. Assemblyman, okay. Steve Englebright, State Senator Todd Kominski. They're going to be back with us in just a second. This is The Full Story on WSHU. It's The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and I'm speaking with State Senator Todd Kominski, Democrat who represents the 9th District on Long Island, and Assemblyman Steve Englebright, also a Democrat, the chair of the Environmental Conservation Committee, and he represents the 4th District. Senator, is this a Green New Deal, New York style?
Well, the branding is not for me to say, but it certainly is our most ambitious leap into tackling climate change, and it does have important components that go beyond that in terms of what it will do to create jobs, to help having a just transition for people who are currently working in sectors that will be impacted by this, and also it lifts up disadvantaged communities that frankly have been dumped on for too long. So I don't think it is the cure for everything, but it certainly is a wide-ranging bill that will change our economy full stop in a very dramatic way. And it also, I really think, is our answer to Washington's inaction, and we're helping show what we could do. So whether Washington calls it a Green New Deal or whatever they want to call it, they've got to do something. And unfortunately, with them failing to act, we are left to handle the state by state, and we're hoping that other states will look toward our example.
Assemblyman, will this mean massive solar power fields, gigantic wind farms out in the Atlantic, more power from hydro? And I'm asking with this in mind. Many fishermen and others have told us, have been on our show, and they're very concerned about the effect on marine life and their livelihood. What can you tell them?
Well, first part of your question was, will it result in renewable energy becoming more important? And the answer is yes. It calls for the new law will call for 9 gigawatts of offshore wind electric generation and 6 gigawatts of distributed photovoltaic solar generation by 2035 and 2025, respectively. We have a vast array of possibilities just using state land. We have 100 miles of Long Island Railroad right-of-way that faces the southern sky where the sun is, and we don't have any solar panels on that right now. So there's an opportunity for community solar. There's an opportunity for us. In fact, to build on the strength of renewables that New York already has, we have about 15% of the energy generation in the state already hydro because of the Niagara Power Project and other large upstate hydro sources. And we build on that, and we anticipate that by 2040, the statewide electrical demand system will be entirely renewable. What do you say to people who are concerned? We share that concern. It has to be done intelligently. It has to be done thoughtfully. We have looked at what the consequences may be of offshore emplacements in the vicinity of where there are important marine mammal populations and bird populations on flyways. We're concerned, and the preliminary environmental impact statements indicate that this can be done without too much negative impact. There will be some impact. We're going into essentially wilderness areas offshore. I don't see a lot of other options, however. If we do not take action to build the electrical system out on a renewable base, then many of the other sectors, the transportation sector, for example, or the housing sector, will not be able to be shifted to away from the use of fossil fuels and in the direction of depending upon electrification. We need recharging station infrastructure across the face of the state, for example, for the transportation sector. All of this is based on the premise that the electric generation can be the first victory, if you will, going forward. That's why the overall date of 2040 is 10 years earlier than the
2050 date.
the out year of 2050.
Bill envisions. Senator, you touched on this before, and I'd like to go into it a little bit more. You're doing this. It's very ambitious, but let's say your neighbors, Connecticut and New Jersey, do nothing. I'm being theoretical, of course, but what if they don't do as much as New York does? What then? At this point, I don't see anything coming out of New York, Connecticut, I should say, like there is in New York. And if I'm on the New York side of the border, if I'm in Putnam or Westchester or Dutchess counties, and I'm looking over at Fairfield and Litchfield, and I'm saying, I'm paying a lot more over here, I'm doing a lot more, and these guys on the other side of the hill aren't doing anything. How fair,
well, you know,
how fair is this?
I just don't know if you will be paying more. You know, the idea is that we are able to scale this up to a point where fairly soon we're able to have it cost less and be environmentally more advantageous. And we're hoping they'll look at that and say that's something we want to do. So I don't think people will imitate what we do overnight because we just did it and it looked good to, you know, pass a bill. But I hope they see what we start to build and want a part of that. It takes a long time to scale up the amount of renewables a state needs, especially as big as New York, but those other states would too. It takes a long time to get the transmission lines ready to move that amount of energy. It takes a long time to train people to work in those fields. So it's going to take some time for us to put that together. But I think when we do, and you will see the prices of the technology and the costs plummet, I think other states are going to want to do this right away. And where are they going to be able to go to learn how to do this, to buy some of that energy, to get workers who are trained? They're going to come to us. Mm. And that's why being a first mover in this area is important. That may not reveal itself in the next year or two, but it should sooner rather than later. And that's what this is about.
Assemblyman, looking around, just with the news in the last week or two, which has been staggering, besides, you know, wildfires in California, flooding, flooding, tornadoes in the Midwest, snow and ice in Mexico.
In Guadalajara.
The polar ice caps melting. We're hearing about permafrost. It's called permafrost because it's supposed to be permanent. Permafrost melting in Antarctica. Every day we hear more and more horrible news. Do you think there's enough time for us to get it right?
Well, it is speculative. Some believe that we've already reached the tipping point. But the scientific consensus seems to be that we have about 10 to 12 years to take definitive action, and that we have a little bit of time. In either event, though, it is incumbent upon us to do something, to do our best, and to do the responsible thing. We believe in the absence of responsible behavior at the federal level, in the context of an executive at the federal level who thinks that it's a good idea to pull our nation out of the Paris Climate Accord, then it falls to the states. And among the states, New York has been a historical leader since our Revolutionary War. And we have stepped up to do the right thing, and we're going to do it again.
Senator Kaminsky, is there enough time for us to get it right?
Look, I think there is, but it certainly requires us to get to do what we're doing right. I don't think we get to do this poorly and then have to do it over. And that's why having this council comprised of the best people, staying on top of it, making sure as a legislature we're ready to act when necessary to help move this forward, working with the governor's office, who has been very aggressive in these areas. I think we have to do what we're doing right, and we got to do it soon. And I think we have to very quickly produce results to show other states and Washington what's possible.
State Senator Todd Kaminsky represents the 9th District. Assemblyman Steve Englebright, the chair of the Environmental Conservation Committee, represents the 4th District. Gentlemen, thank you. I appreciate your time, and I wish you the best of luck for all of us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's the full story on WSHU, and we are going to continue our discussion as to what our future will be like because of climate change. As you heard the senator and assemblyman say, wind power will be a big part of that future. Now, to give us some background as to where some of these wind farms will be in our region, we'd like to welcome back Mark Harrington. Mark covers a lot of ground and water for Newsday. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, I loved in that interview that we did that Assemblyman Englebright had a great line. He said, the future's coming fast. It sounded a bit like Yogi Berra, but I know exactly what he meant. And with that in mind, New York State has one of the most ambitious plans around, and wind power is one of the main components. To start us off, where are all these proposed wind farms going to be?
Well, I think most immediately, the state is preparing to announce, I believe, on the order of about 800 megawatts of offshore wind in a bid by the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. That was supposed to have happened, we thought, in May of this year. It seems like it's been pushed back a little bit. It's important that it happened this year because there are still federal tax credits amounting to about 12% of the cost of the project that are important to get by this year's end. So I think the state is definitely, you know, focused on making this happen. New Jersey has already announced, I believe it's on the order of 1,100 megawatts of wind that they're going to be doing for their state. So New York is a little behind. It may be as much as 1,200 megawatts. This could be somewhat of a larger project. That's, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people would ultimately be served by the grand plan that New York State has for 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind.
Mark, it seems to be taking a long time. Is this normal, or is this just part of the regulatory process?
Well, from the standpoint of, you know, the federal government, they have identified a series of, you know, wind energy areas, and they're going to announce and finalize even more this year. Most of those, by the way, somewhat controversial, some of those are right off the coast of the Hamptons, and so you can expect that supervisors in East Hampton and Southampton are going to be, you know, raising some alarms, and people with houses along the beachfront there are also going to be somewhat concerned about the placement of these turbines, because there's two wind energy areas specifically cover almost the entire the range of the Hamptons all the way out to Montauk.
If I could just ask you, if you're sitting on the beach, will you be able to see the turbines?
I think you will. I mean, you know, the plan is for there's one set of plans right now that are it's would be from about the 12 miles to about 30 miles off the coast of Long Beach all the way to about Patchogue. That's a proposal by a company called Equinor, and they're one of the ones in the bidding for this 800 megawatts. It's the only project that would be off the coast of Long Island right now. But future projects, according to the schedule that the feds have, could potentially see projects around the same distance, maybe up to 20 miles off of the coast of the Hamptons. I think you would see them because right now, if you go to areas of Montauk, I mean, I've been as far east as the Village on a good clear day, you can see the five turbines that are off the coast of Block Island. Mm. It's a 30 megawatt project that was the first in the U.S. that occurred a few years back. So you can see them. The more of them there are, I think that also raises some issues if they're even in the distance. They're not massive. It sometimes takes a little bit to see them, and on a foggy day you can't see them at all. But some people do see them. Some people love them. It's actually encouraged a whole industry of tourism on Block Island. People with fishing boats take visitors out to see the turbines because they and to some people they're very beautiful. And
you're kidding.
A sign of hope for the future.
Wow, I didn't know about this. I mean, so instead of going whale watching, you go wind turbine watching.
Right, you actually go out and you circle the turbines. I mean, there's actually still tours. I mean, it's mostly educational tours from Long Island as well. Fishing boats and other things take people out. But if you go through the guidebooks if you go to Block Island, you go through the guidebooks and things to do. That's one of them, is to go out and take a trip around the turbines. There's even a fishing industry that's grown up around. It's recreational fishing has grown up around things like blackfish and black sea bass congregate around the structure of these turbines. Unfortunately, commercial fishermen don't see it that way, and they see them as, and that's one of the other problems, is that they see these as a real hindrance to their and a threat to their way of life here. So in the case of the most immediate project for Long Island, there was initially a 90 megawatt project that grew to 130 megawatt project, so it's about 15 turbines that would be probably about 50 miles away from East Hampton, off the coast of Rhode Island, and that would have been the very first project. LIPA has already signed a contract for this. It's a $1.62 billion project that is slated to be online by the end of 2022 is the plan right now. They're getting a fair amount of pushback from fishing groups looking at the issues with the cables, concerns about fish migratory behavior changing with cables coming in, the idea that a trawler who's dragging on the ocean floor may get caught up on some of these cables coming in from the turbines. And the fact that you have to navigate around these things, in some cases it's 3/4 of a mile to a mile apart, but when you're in a deep field of wind turbines and it's foggy, it's not an easy thing to navigate. So these are all big concerns that everyone has to address, and I think the more that you have to address, the more it slows things down. The whole regulatory process watches this, takes a lot of feedback. And then you have local issues like wainscot. I mean, there is the cable for the 130 megawatt project for LIPA for the East End. It was scheduled initially to come into an area in a very popular beach in wainscot in the Hamptons. And I was at a hearing about a month ago, and dozens of people turned up, and they're dead set against it. It's like they've gotten petitions with thousands of signatures saying, "Do not let this cable land on our beach. We totally support wind power. We understand climate change. We just don't want the cable here." And so I think those are the issues that are has slowed down this project somewhat locally. They need to look at a potentially alternative location. This would be for Hither Hills in the Montauk area. And there may also be pushback there. People may not want it to come through a state park, so you can expect a battle just about anywhere this cable is going to land. And then, you have the idea that the turbines, very, very large turbines, over 600 feet tall, 700 feet tall, more, are going to be in the water, in this case, off the coast of Rhode Island in Massachusetts. And some people are not all that happy about that. particularly the fishermen on Long Island.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, can you hold on 1 second? I just have one or two more questions, if you don't mind staying with us through the break. And then also joining us after the break is going to be Ross Thomas. And Ross, you probably know, is one of the principals of Horizon Wind, and they have a proposal out there to put up 30 turbines in an area called Fairways North. So Ross is going to be joining us to tell us about that. If you would if you'd like to join in the conversation, we'd like to hear from you. You could email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, and on Twitter, we're at FullStoryWSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Stay with us. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and we're discussing wind power, specifically wind farms off Long Island. Mark Harrington from Newsday is still on the phone with us, and joining us is Ross Thomas. Ross Thomas is one of the principals of Horizon Wind. Horizon Wind has proposed to put 30 wind turbines in an area in the Atlantic, which is off the island's south shore, that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management calls Fairways North. I mentioned Fairways North to someone the other day. They said it sounds like a golf course. It would have an awfully big water hazard, but that's where they want to put it. That's what they call it. Mr. Thomas, thanks for joining us today. How are you, Ross?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for your time. And Ross, if you don't mind holding on for 1 second, Mark is still with us, and I just have one or two quick questions for him before I let him go. Mark, just to clear this up, the power coming from the wind farms, are they going to be for the homes and businesses on Long Island and nowhere else? How does it work?
Yeah, they would. There's a dedicated, for the 90-megawatt project, there's a dedicated cable that would come right into the would come right into the Hamptons. And so the need there would be met first. There is going to be enough, buildup on the grid to move some of this power west. They're fortifying the grid, so some of the power could move west from that project, and certainly the project, the bigger ones that are proposed for off the coast here would have to move through either Long Island or New York City, so that power will certainly make its way onto the Long Island grid, and as a result, some of the power plants may be used less when there's a lot of wind power, especially in the winter.
Okay, so will Long Islanders pay more or less by getting their power from the wind?
They're going to pay more. Right now, what LIPA is saying is about $1.58 more a month for average customers just to pay for the 130 megawatt project off of that's coming through the Hamptons. But as more and more of these come online, the price may come down. However, there's still a premium. Right now, New York State is probably going to be paying. I think for like a gas-powered plant, it's about something like 7 cents a kilowatt hour. Just sort of breaking it down, I think that the number is going to be probably closer to 10 to 15 cents for some of these newer projects. Your next guest may be able to tell us a little bit better what some of those numbers might be, but there is still a premium. There's still a lot of expense that goes into these things. There's cables. There's on land. Improvements that need to be made. So there's a lot of investment that has to happen still, and it's a pretty expensive process just starting out for the United States.
Mark, I don't know what your schedule is. I don't know if you have to run off. You're more than welcome to stay on with us and join in the conversation with Ross Thomas. You tell me what you want to do.
Yeah, I can stay on. I certainly would love to listen to him. I don't have a lot of information about his project, so I'm interested.
Sounds good. Ross Thomas, again, welcome. Thank you for your time. Give us some background. How many wind farms does Horizon Wind have? Where are they? And how long have you been doing this?
So this is our first offshore wind farm. This is the first offshore wind farm in the United States. We've been doing this for about 3 years. I actually come from an energy banking background, and I teamed up with a group of guys who have actually built onshore wind turbines on Long Island. We decided to team up and create a project for offshore wind. We still believe that offshore wind is going to be a dominant utility scale power source in the United States, and there's a lot of potential in this country for it. We put the project together, and we decided on Fairways North. Fairways North is a smaller area, and it's also an area which is not suitable for large-scale farms. So we decided to build a smaller farm, which is only 30 turbines. That, if you compare that to the Equinors and the Vineyard Winds, they're looking at maybe building 100 to 200 wind turbines in their pieces of ocean. So this farm is about 25 miles off Southampton, and the energy need for that area doesn't require a large 800 megawatt farm. We actually calculated that a 300 megawatt farm would be optimal for that area and the energy needs of that area.
So again,
and I just want to address the point from earlier. The guy on the phone, sorry, I didn't catch his name, but the costs, the development costs of this project, the cabling, whether it's in the ocean, whether it's being buried on land, or the actual cost of the turbines, that's all absorbed by the developer. The developer is paying 100% of this project, and this project that I'm working on right now is close to $1 billion. That the developer and investors actually cover themselves. So there's no state dollars coming in here. We can have a conversation about that. But also the fact that the farm is so far out is a considerable additional capex for us, and that's something that we're willing to absorb because we don't feel that the wind farm should be anywhere near close to that BOEM have proposed. We think that 25 miles is the optimal distance, and that will be a minimal visual impact to the residents on Long Island, specifically Southampton.
Okay, and you say BOEM. Once again, I would like to tell our listeners, BOEM is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and the gentleman who's still on the phone with us is Mark Harrington. He covers the energy sector for Newsday, and Mark is still with us. Ross, so your proposed wind farm would be about, I think you said 21 nautical miles from shore. That's about, 24 miles or so?
Yes.
Okay. So if I'm standing on the beach, you're telling me I won't be able to see the turbines?
Well, on a very clear day, you may be able to see a silhouette of the tower. The turbines will be facing a southwesterly direction, so the actual face of the rotor blades, if you think about like the London Eye, for example, it wouldn't be actually facing the shore, it would mm-hmm. be facing away to catch those winds, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So that reduces the visual impact considerably. Yes, on a very clear day, you would see a silhouette of the tower.
If I could just ask
yeah, please question. Jump in, Mark.
Ross, you mentioned that the developer is absorbing all the costs, but doesn't that ultimately get doesn't that all your costs are ultimately reflected in the contract cost to ratepayers? So it's not like you're putting out this money. I mean, you're ultimately going to recoup all your costs through the rates that you're going to charge for this energy, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, so it's not like you're paying for this. You're taking the risk, but you're going to get all your money back plus some through somewhat higher rates.
Well, not necessarily. I'm not sure where the information is coming from that these wind farms would create higher rates for the ratepayer. I haven't heard of this, but I would gladly read any research that's out there. But I haven't. The conversations that I've had with NYSERDA, the ratepayers won't see any higher rates because of the offshore wind development in the near future.
But the LIPA project, they've already said, LIPA, the Long Island utility, has already said that you will, every ratepayer will pay on average of $1.58 a month, you know, in the first year of the production of the 130 megawatt wind farm. So they've already, this is from the local utility. This is the premium that they would be charging for that wind farm.
Okay.
I have a question, Ross, in terms of when construction would begin. It seems to me that this is taking, Mark and I talked about this a little bit earlier, it seems to be that this is part of the approval process and it's taking longer than expected. But let's say you get the approval to do this.
Yes.
When would construction begin and when would the wind farm start generating power?
So construction, construction would begin at the end of 2021, early 2022, and we hopefully will be spinning by end of Q1 2023.
I'm making my notes here. 2023 at the earliest.
At the earliest, yes.
And Ross, I had a question because I know New York State has not.
Yes, sorry, go on.
New York State has not backed the idea of wind farms off of the Hamptons. They have proposed or they have agreed to, you know, BOEM's outlook for wind farms in other areas, including the New York Bight and some other areas. Mm-hmm. But they have their map for proposed areas or the ones that they support excluded the areas off the Hamptons. Can you give us a sense of why that is and how you expect to get around that?
Well, first of all, New York State doesn't have jurisdiction over BOEM. BOEM is a federal agency, so therefore, whatever BOEM says goes. They will take New York State's comments, but if those areas are deemed developable for those areas, then BOEM will go ahead with that. We don't really understand. There have been a few negative comments from New York State from these areas, for these areas, specifically Fairways North, Fairways South. But we believe that the state and the federal government will come together and agree that actually these areas are extremely well, great for development. We've got some of the highest wind speeds in the area on Fairways North and South. We've got some of the lowest fishing activity for the whole of New York Bight in those areas. So I just don't really understand what the pushback is. Maybe there's some donors in the Hamptons that are pushing back, and maybe it's a political thing. I'm not sure. But at the same time, I think that that New York State and the federal government will see that actually these areas are extremely well suited for offshore wind development. And again, BOEM control federal waters which these are in. So I know the cable will feed into land, but I just don't think that this is a bad area for offshore wind development.
Huh. Ross, I have a question that may seem a bit different, but we've been socked by some massive storms the past few years in this region. Nor'easters, tornadoes, hurricanes. Can the wind turbines take a direct hit?
Of course. These turbines are sat in waters in Europe right now. But very similar wind conditions in European waters. There hasn't been a turbine collapse. The wind turbines actually are programmed to cut out at certain speeds, so that the anything kinetic that is anything that's moving during storms is a risk. So to have those stop will reduce the risk of any damage to those turbines. Yes, there may be some damage to the blades. But I don't think that there's a huge risk there.
What are you going to do if your proposal is turned down or if the government decides not to use the area? What do you do next?
Well, in January, there's a bidding process. And Horizon Wind Power has been qualified financially and technically to actually bid on any area in the New York Bight. So there are areas that we are currently assessing for offshore wind development. But again, this is the area that we've chosen, and we're very optimistic that it'll get approved.
What is it about this process that you find most vexing?
Well, I come from the UK, we're part of the European Union, which is extremely bureaucratic. And I actually thought that the US would be less bureaucratic, but we're dealing with something like 30 federal, state, and local agencies, all trying to agree with each other, not talking to each other properly, it's a bit of a nightmare for developers. We work closely with BOEM, but we're not seeing the support and the guidance from them.
It sounds like you're looking for one agency that would simply streamline the process.
Well, we were hoping that would be BOEM, and you know that what I've come to realize is that it doesn't matter if you're a federal agency or what, like. Those departments are not talking to each other, and what we've come to realize is that it's up to the developers to actually do that and organize those meetings. And another thing as well is that they are having meetings, but developers are not being included in those meetings. And we have spent years researching these areas. We understand these areas from top to bottom. We can add valuable assistance to these people, and it would be great if we were included. Whether it's me, whether it's Vineyard Wind, whether it's Equinor, you know, there's a huge amount of expertise on the private side that could help push this along. This country is in dire need of renewable power, and unfortunately, it's been stalled right now. By agencies that aren't talking to each other, and it's very sad.
Mark, I have time for about 30 seconds of final comments. You have any final thoughts?
Well, I think one of the issues that you're dealing with is both it's the local level, the state level, and the federal level. Everyone has been kind of surprised that BOEM, you know, with the Trump administration, Trump had been, at least in New York, had been an opponent of wind power. He seems to have at least let the agency go and to actually encourage, wind leasing. What you're seeing with the state is that the state has no jurisdiction, but they do have the ability to award contracts for power. So that gives them just as much power as the federal government in terms of, awarding these leases and, you know, having a say in terms of the siting. And that's probably one of Ross's frustrations here is that he's got to, he has to have a contract with the state in order to offload his power. And then you have the local governments and local people who are, in some cases, not always happy about a cable coming into their area, or fishing people not
Absolutely.
Really happy about losing ground.
So Mark,
those
Mark,
are the frustrations.
Thank you. I got to get running. Mark, as always, a pleasure. Thank you for your expertise and your time. I much appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. Mark Harrington from Newsday. Ross Thomas, one of the principals of Horizon Wind. Ross, thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
That's it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer, Carrie Frank, digital editor, associate producers Christian Curtis, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer, Ann Lopez is the senior producer, and Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.